You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of February 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello from Midori House here in London, and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, coming to you live from Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's show. From the streets of Venezuela, where violent protests continue, to the Cairo courtroom, where Al Jazeera journalists stand trial, I'll unpack the day's news with Oscar Guardiola Rivera and George Brock. Then we'll continue our Italy series by profiling a woman that is cleaning up Italian television, Anna Maria Tarantola.
One of the main things she's done is go in and impose a meritocratic regime on this organisation that is actually governed by the political elite.
That was our Sophie Grove, not Ms. Tarantola. Plus, are French crime novels really taking over Scandi noir and the Stieg Larsson heritage? That's what the publishing industry says. Kathy Retzenbrink from The Bookseller will be here to tell us more, and we'll review the Berlin Film Festival with Tim Robey.
It's so beautiful and kind of full of this gliding menace all the time. There are shots of characters on ice rinks and someone stalking them around an ice rink, and it's done in one unbroken take. It's kind of mesmerizing and quite hypnotic.
That's Midori House, live from London, here on Monocle 24. And with the time just going almost 18:02 here in Studio One at Midori House, time for the World News with Jonathan Wheatley.
Ukraine opposition leaders have signed a deal with President Viktor Yanukovych to end the political crisis. The deal was the result of talks mediated by three EU foreign ministers from France, Germany and Poland. The agreement includes a national unity government and for a presidential election to be held before the end of the year. Mr. Yanukovych says he's also agreed constitutional changes which would reduce the power of the president. Earlier, 3 hours of fierce fighting in Independence Square left dozens dead, with the death toll this week rising now nearly to 100. In the United States, the Deputy White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest said Washington was watching the situation very closely.
When we see the basic human rights of anybody around the globe being so flagrantly trampled, that has certainly been part of the situation that appears to be underway in Ukraine. And that is the source of great concern here at the White House.
Armed Basque separatist group ETA has put some of its arsenal of guns and explosives beyond use. International group monitoring the militant ceasefire said on Friday. The move by the Basque group mirrors the decommissioning process in Northern Ireland, where nationalist and pro-British paramilitaries disposed of their weapons in front of independent witnesses as part of a peace deal ending decades of violence. Nigeria's graft-fighting central bank governor Lamido Sanusi said on Friday he'll go to court to challenge his suspension by the president, though he doesn't want his job back. He just wants to show that the move was illegal. President Goodluck Jonathan suspended Sanusi on Thursday, removing an outspoken critic of his government's record on corruption in Africa's top oil producer. But Sanusi still insists that the bank has followed every correct procurement procedures.
There is a section of the act that says the president cannot remove the governor without two-thirds of the Senate. There was a reason for that section. You cannot go round that section by saying, I'm not removing you, I'm suspending you. You cannot do that because it undermines the entire principle. So for me, I think we should challenge it. I think it should be challenged so that governors coming after me will not refuse to act or will not refuse to be independent for fear that they will be suspended.
A Russian judge has convicted eight defendants of rioting and assaulting police at a protest against Vladimir Putin. In a show of force outside the courthouse, police pushed into a crowd of hundreds that gathered to support the defendants, grabbing people one by one and hauling them away. Moscow police said they've detained about 200 people for attempting to violate public order. Some business news now, and the Australian Treasurer Joe Hockey's decision to put growth at the top of this year's G20 agenda has been welcomed by most business leaders. Hockey spoke in Sydney of the G20 finance ministers and central bankers meeting, the first under Australia's 2014 presidency of the G20.
Governments around the world haven't got the money that is going to address the infrastructure needs of both the developing world and the developed world. So we need to facilitate private sector investment. Our private sectors, both in the United States and Australia, but also right around the world, are very well resourced at the moment. And what we've got to do is facilitate that investment.
And finally, in Argentina, a judge has halted a trial because he accused a defence lawyer of a lack of decency and respect shown to the court for a wardrobe malfunction. The lawyer in question had arrived without wearing a tie. The hearing for an assault case at a court in Chubut was halted because of a crime of fashion. The criminal trial began after a two-hour delay so the lawyer could get properly dressed. And Tyler, you'll be delighted to hear that the lawyer found a green tie and not a purple tie. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. There'll be more from you in about 24 minutes' time here on Monocle 24, where you're listening to Midori House. We're back in a moment.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, see on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Just 18:06 here in London. It is 13:06 if you're listening in Toronto, Montreal, or New York. Now, joining me here in the studio with her take on the news is Oscar Guardiola Rivera, senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck University of London, and also George Brock, head of journalism at City University here in London. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. A lot to get through today.
There's a lot happening.
I don't know where we want to go. We're probably a little bit Olympics'd out at this moment, but there was a bit of a protest theme, and of course that's been sort of largely muffled in and around Sochi. Today's news is, of course, dominated in part, of course, Ukraine, but also Venezuela as well, as Viktor Yanukovych and the Ukrainian opposition have agreed on calling an early election after yesterday's bloodshed, as you just heard in the news bulletin. In Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro has instead called in the armed forces to go to one border state where the unrest has been particularly fierce. Pro-government vigilante groups are alleged to scour the streets looking to muzzle protesters. And yet Western coverage has been lacking, as Venezuelan journalist Francisco Toro has pointed out in one particularly powerful blog post for the Caracas Chronicle. Toro writes, "After the major crackdown on the streets of major and minor Venezuelan cities last night, I expected some kind of response in the major international news outlets this morning. Instead, he found nothing in the morning's press." Oscar, don't mean to come to you first, but I'm going to. What do you make of this? I mean, your read on one side, is it global news organizations spread too thin that just, you know, Kiev manages to trump Caracas? What is it?
No, I think your blogger is being disingenuous. In fact, you know, all major outlets have been reporting on the crisis in Venezuela in various ways. Some of them have been quick to follow the line that this is just the deed of a government trying to muzzle street protesters, while others, for instance, the neutral Últimas Noticias or Caracas Ciudad CCS, have been pointing out that there is a division in Venezuela's opposition, and that this is, among other things, in fact, an internal coup in which the more belligerent members of the opposition are ousting the moderate ones led by Enrique Capriles, the best well-known figure of the opposition. And yet others, Al Jazeera, even CNN and Espanol, have been rectifying their initial broadcast and saying that this context may be correct, that in fact, as VenezuelaAnalysis.com was reporting this morning, Maduro has called for a dialogue with the opposition. He needs to do that. He needs to get closer to the moderate sectors of the opposition. Otherwise, the more recalcitrants will make things a lot harder.
I mean, do you think he's also getting at the fact, though, and whether he's looking at front pages or not? So, okay, Times of London this morning, you know, bloody carnage in Kiev. This dominates, you know, well above the fold of the newspaper, and doesn't get, you know, Venezuela doesn't get sort of too much. Now, this is an isolated example. Now, of course, we can look at the newspapers, which are part of the Spanish-speaking world. It's there, and even as you reference, it's CNN en Español. It's not sort of the top three headlines on CNN International. Is that probably what this gentleman has a beef about?
Well, that is unsurprising. The coverage of news in the Americas, particularly when it comes to Latin America, is rather absent here in Europe and also in the United States. So, you know, I'm not surprised that the newspapers here in London began with the Kiev story. As a witness on the ground put it, well, the difference is that this is happening in either the heart or the fringes of Europe, and that makes a change.
Mm. I understand. I kind of sympathize and understand with the distress of that blogger in Caracas who's saying, where is the reporting of this? Why aren't people realizing what's going on in my country? Policemen are just killing people on the streets and so on and so on. The fact is, actually, editors of news programs or newspapers, whatever it happens to be, have to take some notice of what their readers are actually interested in. And sorry, here in Britain, what is going on in the Ukraine, which bears on the centuries-old rivalry between Russia and Western Europe, and particularly Germany, really does matter more directly to us here, I'm afraid, than what goes on in Venezuela. What is going on in Venezuela may be appalling, but it is, sorry, further away. And editors know that viewers, listeners, readers know that.
Is it, you know, so let's say you're putting tonight's bulletin together for a major broadcaster, which, you know, may have reach even beyond these borders, George. The Venezuela story, is it an item five? Would you link it to the Ukraine story and do a bit of a global protest wrap up? You know, where would you see?
You might do, but the characteristics and the motives and the and what's driving these things are so varied. Mm. It would be further down than Kiev, yes. There is some fairly remarkable video stuff from the streets of Caracas. I'd certainly want it there.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think the blogger in Caracas is completely wrong. People are being a little bit slow to focus on the fact that what Maduro has done is gear up what's happening. I mean, he really has told paramilitary people to go out and kill people in order to discourage them. That's a change.
Mm. From a news gathering point of view, George, are you surprised that there hasn't been a greater mobilization for the region in general with networks, you know, at least saying, okay, should we have something in the northeast of the continent, a proper presence where we can really look after everything from Mexico, what's happening in the Caribbean, as much as Venezuela and Colombia. We've seen, of course, the shuffle to people opening bureaus in Sao Paulo for obvious reasons right now. So there's been a bit of mobilization towards Brazil. But, you know, oftentimes, you know, the commercial opportunities for all of these networks and print publications, well, they're in lockstep with, are they going to get advertising for the region? Okay, you know, we might also open a bureau down there as well.
It slightly depends on where your network is based. You know, the American networks do this, and they go up, and the levels of coverage in Latin America, in North America, go up and down, just as the levels of coverage in European capitals go up and down here in Britain. But actually, for Europeans, it's still quite a distance away in news terms. Now, you're also looking, you hinted at it a moment ago, you're also looking at the fact that a lot of news organizations have their commercial, their backs against the wall commercially, and life is extremely tough. I mean, you know, some have had to pull in international networks. I think in the medium term, that will probably improve. But right now, it's pretty stiff.
Mm. I want to come back to your sort of glimmer of optimism there as to why improve. Also, I just wanted your view on that. I mean, at a time when even you can talk to a hotel manager in London, they get incredibly excited. Oh, Mexican people are checking in. Mexicans are going to spend lots of money. They're going to book the biggest suites. People are very excited about, you know, the Brazilian spend, et cetera. So, I mean, sitting in London, you know, looking at, you know, the power of these economies, everyone's sort of very excited about Colombia again. You know, how do you see this? And do you think that we start to see a bit of a coverage shift and change that, it's important what's happening, of course, in Eastern Europe and as we move towards the stands, but also there should be a little bit more from Bogota, from Caracas, and elsewhere.
I think you're absolutely right in pointing out that things are changing. I mean, George is correct in saying that the old business imperatives are still there. And it's not just the old business imperatives. It's also the, remnants of all colonial ties. There is a history of relations and areas of influence that does have effect here. But as my friends in The Guardian have told me several times, they are now recognizing that there is an important, for instance, in the case of London, Latino community and Hispanic community, which is an important market, which is now being covered by newspapers of their own, all of which survive with advertisement. And they are beginning to rethink their strategies. Hopefully that will happen soon. In the case of the United States, we have two segmented markets. You have CNN in English, but you have CNN in Espanol, which is huge. And of course, with the States soon to become the next Latin American country, we may see things changing even more.
Three things are going to kick up coverage of Latin America in the next few years. Two huge football tournaments. One, the fact that in digital news, people can get their information from a very much wider range of sources, obviously, and if people want it, they will get it, and demand will change it. And secondly, in London, it is just becoming a more and more international city all the time. I know people have said this for years, and it's perfectly true, but the fact is the process goes on. We're just welcoming more and more visitors, and the more we have, for example, there's a minor boom in London, in, of all things, you know, translated literature translation. I went to a live event the other day. It was actually in French, but there were 200 people there. It was booked out. They spent 20 minutes discussing the placing of a comma. That's what translators do.
Yeah, exactly.
People loved it. They were fascinated.
Must have been a great meeting.
Oh, it was terrific. It was good.
Gentlemen, we're going to take a very, very short break right now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Blay, also Oscar Guadalupe-Rivera and George Brock. When we come back, we're going to be, of course, sticking with the theme of journalism. Not a very happy state in Egypt. Stay with us.
The Singapore Air Show is a magnet for the world's most important aerospace companies, all of them eager to sell to the high-flying Asia-Pacific market. Monocle got strapped in to gauge the state of the soaring industry.
The requirements for new military equipment here are vast and include not only combat and surveillance aircraft, but tankers and transports as well. Patrolling maritime borders was, however, one of the more dominant themes, and that's no surprise given current tensions in the region.
Pushington at the 2014 Singapore Air Show, premiering in the Films menu on Monocle.com.
All around the world, Monocle 24's growing network of correspondents bring you the latest news, reportage and insight from New York to Nairobi, Bamako to Berlin.
For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Kimberly Bradley.
For Monocle in Pristina.
In New York.
In Cairo.
In Sao Paulo.
I'm Guy Delorme.
For Monocle.
For Monocle.
In Tel Aviv.
For Monocle.
In San Francisco.
In North Vancouver.
In Ramallah.
I'm Aisha Spears.
I'm Joseph Dane.
For Monocle, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
In Bogota.
In London.
Bangkok.
Buenos Aires.
So, whether you want to know what's happening in the corridors of power, in the boardrooms of the aviation giants, or the must-sees at the latest film festival, stay tuned to Monocle 24. Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I am with Oscar Guadalupe-Rivera and George Brock. Now, a little bit earlier, of course, we were talking about all things related to, of course, the protests in Venezuela. But George said that he thought that maybe sort of median term, we might see a slight improvement. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here, but a slight improvement in the state of, I guess, news gathering and maybe resources out on the field. Is that correct? And if that is the case, why do you think things will improve? Is it consolidation, more people joining forces?
Well, because apart from anything else, pure play online news sites are now getting bigger and yeah, they've grabbed some big audiences, and as always happened in journalism's history, once you've grabbed a very big audience, suddenly people sometimes turn around and say, hang on a minute, we've got a journalism mission. We can write long things, we can do this, we can do that, because we've got the funds, we've got the viewers, the audience, the users, whatever it is. Mm. You can see Vox, you can see Vice, you can see BuzzFeed going into long-form reportage. They're not doing it absolutely brilliantly. They're not going to knock the BBC off its perch anytime soon, but nevertheless, they're starting, and it's a very important change, which is why in the medium term, I'm optimistic that those international networks, they will rebuild. They'll be in different style. People will report different things. Reporters will be younger. They won't be the old seasoned correspondents. Style will be different, a bit like Monocle maybe. But things are changing, and on the whole, I think they're going to change in the right direction net over time.
Oscar, do you feel as optimistic and excited when you look at what the prospects for your morning, afternoon, or evening news buffet could be?
Oh, it's incredibly, it's incredible what is happening, particularly in with digital media. In the Americas, for instance, you have this very exciting network of blogs and digital sites, which include La Silla Vacía in Colombia, or The Clinic in Chile, and you see real quality journalism coming out of those sites. Earlier this year, Carl Bernstein, of all people, was praising The Clinic. And if that is the future, I think there is reason to be optimistic.
Let's stay with journalism. I'm heading to Egypt. The trial against three detained Al Jazeera journalists was supposed to start yesterday, but it was postponed until the 5th of March after the men were refused bail. Another six staff members are to be tried in absentia. Reporters are accused of aiding a terrorist organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. The network says its journalists were doing their job, namely reporting on the military coup against Mohamed Morsi. I will start with you, George. I mean, just the fact, there's so many sides to it. I mean, I also sort of look at just brand Egypt in general, and I think, you know, already not a great sort of string of events against journalists, and then on the one side, then you see, of course, the country also complaining about what might happen to tourists, and you sort of think, well, what tourists are going to go there, at least right-minded ones right now? No self-awareness in a way.
Well, I'm possibly no self-awareness. There are two kinds of ways you can crack down on journalism you don't like. You can either hit it directly, or you can start a kind of predatory manipulation whereby you get the private sector to do your dirty work for you. To some extent, that was what was going on in Venezuela. In Egypt, it's much more direct. They're just putting them in the slammer. Now, to some extent, it's not an accident these are journalists from Al Jazeera. If there's one country the current Egyptian military regime is really, really angry about, it's Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based. They consider that Qatar is the source of much of that has gone wrong, and they appear, I would guess, it can only be a guess, that they have targeted Al Jazeera journalists for that reason. But this is just a direct attack. I don't think they're very worried about their international image. They hate Al Jazeera. They hate Qatar. This is a very direct blow aimed straight at, you know, at that very small country.
Yeah, that small country, that increasingly more powerful and influential media brand. Mohamed Fahmy and Peter Grest, Canadian and Australian. Does that play into this as well? Is that maybe their get-out card that maybe Egypt thinks, Australia, okay, it's, you know, Canberra's not Washington and Ottawa's not Washington. Do they care? Or is that probably the only hope that there might be some type of back-channel discussion going on? Or is it too late for that?
It hadn't previously crossed my mind, but you're probably right that they carefully avoided arresting an American employee. It's Al Jazeera, English, they've gone after all here. They could have gone after an American journalist. They haven't. One of the ones who very narrowly got out was a Dutch journalist, if I remember rightly. But can I just remind you that they have had in prison since last summer an Arabic member of Al Jazeera's Arabic staff who's on hunger strike at the moment, Abdullah Al-Shami. So this is a long-running war. This isn't something they suddenly decided to do yesterday.
No.
Yes, they've opened a new front, but it's not the first time they've taken this kind of action.
No. I guess on the other side of it, Oscar, if you are another regime, also looking to, exercise questionable means in dealing with journalists. Is there a precedent, obviously a very ugly precedent, that could be set here as well if we don't see, more of an upsurge, not just in discussion, but maybe proper outcry from the international community?
That is true, but we must also be very careful to distinguish these cases. The Egyptian case is absolutely not the same case as Venezuela.
No, of course. But
in one case, you have a military government who is cracking down on journalism, and it reminds me of that old joke, militaries complaining because they have to recruit their peers among civilians. That's precisely the problem here. They see that they have to control civilian opinion, and they turn that into a battlefield, even a geopolitical battlefield, as you pointed out. In the case of Venezuela, it's very different. There you have a revolutionary government confronting the press in its variegated forms. Of course, one would wonder whether one can defend the freedom of the press of Gustavo Cisneros to join a military coup, as he did in 2003. Imagine what would happen if, I don't know, the Daily Mail were to call a coup d'etat on a Labour government. That would not be allowed. So we have to differentiate these cases. But clearly, the path is careful discussion and careful distinction of what is happening elsewhere in the world. I think you're very, very correct, Tyler, in pointing out that if we want our audience to be much more enlightened, we journalists and analysts must also go to the different corners of the world to see how things happen differently.
But what the Egyptian authorities are doing is they are also attacking the ability of international organizations to understand what is going on. You were asking me a moment ago, Tyler, about the fact that they'd arrested an Australian. But let's not forget that the other two, one of them, Mr. Fahmy, is an Egyptian and Canadian citizen. He's worked for CNN, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times. He's written a book about the Egyptian uprising. He's just become the bureau, or just become when arrested, the bureau chief of Al Jazeera English in Cairo. Now, one of the things that authorities in this kind of situation do is they do their absolute best to separate the international media from the people who help them, who know how to speak the language, who understand life on the ground, who can get on the street. That makes life much more difficult when you really discourage, and this will discourage, people helping international media like that. Mm. It's much tougher.
And if you are a news editor sitting in Doha, George, reporting to the ruling family in Qatar, what do you think is going on the editorial floor there right now?
Well, they're a very tough organization. They're very resilient, and they have been through quite a lot of extremely bad difficulties of this kind. So I don't think they will be panicked or shocked, but they are caught in what looks to be like a crossfire between these two states, these two regimes, if you like, which could very well last for years. And I think you would have to sit down and think very hard about how you were going to protect your people in the future, because if they're going to be taken hostage, you've got to start acting differently.
Yeah, and that is not just hostile environment training. Well, it's one part of it. The worst part, yeah, if you find yourself in captivity. Just before we go, a little bit of a report that came out said that it may be positive for the media industry in general. It says one media branding agency has conducted a study that proves that negative headlines engage the public 63% more than positive headlines. So is it really better to always lead with the worst news ever?
Will Self was pointing out in his New Statesman column this week that, you know, to live in a world full of difficulties does impact the unconscious. And indeed, it seems that we're becoming more and more inclined to look at, you know, the worst and those kinds of terms being used in news broadcast. But that also means that our audiences may be taking stock of the fact that the facts on the ground are complicated, that we live in difficult times. And if that is the case, then I would go for, you know, the old adage, optimism of the will, but pessimism of the intellect.
Or George, I mean, is it still the case at City as well that you're telling all, all new recruits at school that if it bleeds, it leads?
I think this item is in itself a terrible, distressing, appalling and frightful example of negativity about journalism. Well, we're telling journalists to think sensibly about human nature. When you sit down and you say to somebody gossipy way, have you heard about X? Generally speaking, you're not going to tell people good news about X, is it? I mean, it is to some extent human nature. We do know this a bit. I don't think this is news.
No, this is true though, but it is amazing when you I'll think of sort of one environment where there is, you know, a certain sense of muzzling or guidance on the main news organ out of that country. And I think of whenever I spend time in Singapore with the Straits Times, and there is such a sort of a heavy overlay of the happy clappy in the newspaper. And if you're sort of, yeah, it's just a simple, you know, a very, very sort of, you know, not just simple observation, but simple exercise to go through. It's like, you know, what do you want to be closer to? You know, whether Singapore feels that they're in bed with Kiev or they want to be nice to Brussels. I think you sort of really want the reality fully unpacked on the front page. Gentlemen, we're going to have to leave it there. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, very good to see you. And George Brock from Citi, thanks very much. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Lots more to come. Short break.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24. 런던으로부터 모노클 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monaco 24.
Oi, London. 这是 Monaco 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monaco 24.
Fra London, dette Monaco 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monaco 24.
It is 18:29 in about 43 seconds here at Midori House in London. You are listening to Monocle 24. Still plenty to come in the next half hour of today's show. We continue our Italy series with a more positive look at the media industry in Italy of all places. And in the last installment of our Italy series, our senior editor Sophie Grove tells us about a woman that is transforming her country's television landscape.
One of the main things she's done is go in and impose a meritocratic regime on this organisation that is actually governed by the political elite.
Our Sophie Grove, they'll be hearing a bit more from her a little bit later. But of course, we're going to be hearing much more, though, from Jonathan Wheatley. He's here with the World Headlines.
Thank you very much. Ukraine's opposition leaders have signed a deal with President Viktor Yanukovych to end the political crisis there. The agreement includes a national unity government and for a presidential election to be held before the end of the year. Armed Basque separatist group ETA has put some of its arsenal of guns and explosives beyond use. An international group monitoring the militant ceasefire said on Friday the move by the Basque group mirrors the decommissioning process in Northern Ireland. A Russian judge on Friday has convicted eight defendants of rioting and assaulting police at a protest against Vladimir Putin. In a show of force outside the courthouse, police pushed into a crowd of hundreds that had gathered to support the defendants, grabbing people one by one and hauling them away. And the Australian Treasurer Joe Hockey's announcement that he will put growth at the top of this year's G20 agenda has been welcomed by most business leaders. Hockey will be hosting the G20 Finance Ministers and Central Bankers meeting, the first under Australia's 2014 presidency of the G20. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monaco 24.
Thanks very much for that, Jonathan. I do believe you're with our listeners right up until midnight.
Just beyond midnight, you're
just
absolutely
beyond
right.
Midnight. Yes. Excellent. Okay, more from you at the top of the hour at 1900 here in London. It's what time is it right now? Well, it's 18:31 here in London. It is 16:31 if you're listening in Rio de Janeiro. Now, for the fifth and final part of our week-long Italy series here on Midori House, and to coincide with the release of our Italian special of this very nice magazine that we put out every month, we've been opening up the March issue and delving into some of the stories and themes. Today, we reach for the telecomando, that's the remote control, and have a look at what's on Italian television. Long the epitome of bad taste and questionable quality, TV in Italy has had a bad name both at home and abroad. One woman, however, has been resolutely trying to change all that. Since being appointed as president of state broadcaster Rai in 2012, Anna Maria Tarantola has been on a mission to make this vast network leaner, meaner, and more principled. Our senior editor, Sophie Grove, went to Rome to meet Rai's president and spoke to David Pleasant to give us a profile of this feisty force in Italian media.
So, Sophie, you met Anna Maria Tarantola, the president of Rai. Can you kind of introduce this lady, this person in the kind of scene of the Italian media? Who is she? What's her background?
Well, unusually for the chief of the television network and radio network, in fact, she spent 40 years at the Bank of Italy. She is an incredible economist, and she was really asked to come to Rai at a moment of crisis by Mario Monti and balance the books, really. With that experience that she had from working in Milan at the Bank of Italy, teaching at the Catholic University there, and sort of fix this organisation.
And she seems, from pictures, and there's a wonderful portrait of her in the magazine, in the Italian issue, she seems quite a fearsome figure. There's something of the kind of headmistress, let's say. Did she seem like that when you met her in her office in Rome?
She's an incredibly warm, almost grandmotherly person. At the same time, she was very austere. I mean, she looks like a cross between the Queen of England and Margaret Thatcher, the former Prime Minister of England. Yes, she was very stately, incredibly warm though. I mean, once she started talking about her life, she was telling me about her father, and she said she came from a very simple family. Her father had a really great belief in sort of hard work meritocracy and equality for his daughter. And also she's applying that philosophy to Rai, which had gone sort of badly awry in its own philosophy and its own values as a public service broadcaster. One of the main things she's done is go in and impose a meritocratic regime on this organisation that is actually governed by the political elite. 7 out of 9 people on the board of Rai are political appointees. So even from the outset, it has that weakness in a way. It struggles to be independent. And under Berlusconi, if you consider his domination of the media in Italy, it really seemed to lose its sense of education, its sense of culture, its sense of what really Italy needs for its public broadcasting network.
Funny you mentioned Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Thatcher was always someone who kind of shied away from talking about anything vaguely to do with something like feminism or the role of the woman. Did she have a view on this? Does she kind of have a mission?
She felt that diversity in the workplace was essential to economic prosperity in Europe. She said that women shouldn't act like men in the workplace, they should act like women, and that has been proven to strengthen productivity. So that's the economist in her. Then she talked about, being a woman herself, the challenges of bringing up children. And she said it was a huge challenge and there is very little support, which is something lots of women I spoke to in Italy said. And then she said, well, she wants to make sure that women on Rai are represented as they are in Italy, as strong, productive, important members of the economy. She said that she feels it's her duty, in fact, to make sure that that happens and that what goes out on the network is a reflection of what women are today. She actually said that Rai, she feels, has done quite a good job on gender representation in its dramas. If anyone's turned on Rai or any Italian TV show, they'll see that Italian TV, rather, is filled with showgirls and filled with this type of sensationalism that she really is the antithesis of. She represents something very, very different. And I can see that she will make a big difference to the editorial output of that organisation.
That was our Sophie Grove speaking about Rai's direttore, Anna Maria Tarantola. And now, to continue the conversation, I'm joined in studio by David Pleasant, who, of course, was interviewing our Sophie Grove in that piece, our expert on all things Italian. David, you want to discuss one specific show on Rai, and that's Blob, a sort of potpourri of the best and worst in Italian television. And I guess the first question I do have to ask is, do you think Anna Maria endorses this show?
I think she would. It's a fantastic show. I have to describe it to listeners. It's got no captions, no narration, just a straight up montage of clips. And we're actually going to hear a little bit of an extract from a recent show last week.
Mi verrebbe da dire, soprattutto chi vuole venire qui al posto mio deve dire che cosa vuole fare. Cavolo al mese, lei!
8.000 euro.
8.000 euro.
E le dico
all'anno?
Di più. Sa cosa vorrei io?
All'anno?
Sì, mi faccia finire.
No, all'anno!
Faccia per 12, faccia per 12.
Risponda!
So I'll explain that. It probably doesn't make any sense to anyone who listened to it. It was Enrico Letta on the last days of his tenure as prime minister. Then it went on to a cabaret, a show, a reality TV show, and then on to a famous drag queen arguing with a host of a show. So real mixed bag.
Right.
And what's interesting about Blob is how well it always does in the ratings. And it's become a kind of vanguard of political and social satire on Italian TV when, as Sophie discussed, the reputation of Italian TV isn't so great and people tend to switch off. This is the one show that is quite respected in its own way.
And respected because there's no, I mean, obviously, you know, there's someone, you know, creating the editorial lineup for it and deciding, you know, what goes where, et cetera. So it must have a bit of a political theme, albeit sort of nuanced within it all.
Exactly. And we did actually, the producer of Blob, Christiana Turchetti, came to Midori House and we interviewed her. And that's, you can listen to that on The Culture Show, this week's Culture Show with with Robert Bound. She did say that obviously that the political opinion or leanings of the producer is bound to show. But I think what the main theme is to try and lighten the news, to try and give it a producer's take, a kind of a broad look at what can be a pretty ridiculous state of affairs in Italy.
Mm. And just finally, before we go, I always find it fascinating, and sitting in Asia last week, you know, you flip on television, you see, you know, Rai TV, you know, the international service, which again is a bit of a, you know, a montage of all the different things they do across their various channels. And there is this, a very peculiar, very difficult to describe style of Italian presentation. The way Italians read the news, that it's almost like bingo calling, that yours, you know, it doesn't matter the suit or the dress that newsreader happens to be wearing. There is that sort of sense of yelling at you that they don't even, you know, need microphones. And I guess on one side it looks not particularly modern, but then it is sort of, then it just is uniquely Italian. And that's one of the amazing things, I think, about Italy. One of the fascinating things we found about this issue is that, you know, sometimes it's just the place is impenetrable to the forces of a globalized world.
Exactly. It's almost like modern trends don't really cross the Alps when it comes to media. But there is that fluidity. I think that's one good thing about Italian media and the TV in particular. There's a fluidity. Things like Blob can exist, whereas in America or perhaps the rest of Europe, copyright laws would infringe. I mean, you just wouldn't be able to rip off those kind of clips in the same way, the producer told us. So, I mean, it is a strange kind of broadcast, but one, you know, worth watching nonetheless.
Excellent. David Pleasant, have a very good weekend.
Thank you very much, Tyler.
Up next, we'll find out whether Nordic countries are really being overshadowed by France when it comes to crime writing. Stay tuned to find out more on this episode of Midori House.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Monocle 24. This is Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé. It is just 1942. If you are listening in Paris now, to the bookworms among you, anyone with a penchant for the thrillers has been well and truly spoiled for choice over the past few years. But one genre from one corner of the world has dominated the crime thriller market internationally. Scandinavian noir novels have become staples on bestseller lists from New York to Tokyo. Think Stieg Larsson and Henning Mankell. But is a new national brand of crime fiction about to ascend to the throne? Well, for crime fiction writers in France, interest from international English language publishers has never been so high. These pacey tales of intrigue set in Paris and beyond have become the focus for the world's leading publishing houses, who are on the hunt for the next big literary hit. So, is French crime writing the pretender to Scandinavia's thriller throne? Well, to answer this, I'm joined by Kathy Rensenbrick, Associate Editor for The Bookseller, which, of course, is a trade title of some influence, some serious influence, here in the UK. She joins me in the studio. Welcome.
Hello.
So, is it just a case of fatigue in the stacks, on the shelves, that you've had the Norwegian names, of course, you know, maybe led by the Swedes, the Danes, we've seen the Finns jumping in as well. It's all there. Doesn't matter whether you go to Dance or whether you're at Barnes & Noble. Were people just simply, you know, tired of all of these stories, most of them sort of set in forbidding places in fjords and in ice fields? And it was just time to maybe get back to sort of big, sexy metropolitan life. And how nice to have books set in countries that also border the Mediterranean.
Yeah, all those freezing climates, isn't it? I don't think Scandinavian fiction is at all over. What it is I think that it's become mainstream. So especially now we have TV programmes like The Killing, and everybody's very interested in it. Every book by Jo Nesbø, for example, is a big publishing event. There's going to be this new Stieg Larsson book next year written by somebody else. So I think people are still increasingly interested. But because it's become mainstream, because it's become so successful, what there is space for something new and exciting and cutting edge in the way that the Girl with the Dragon Tattoos books were. Several years ago now.
Do you think this will go the direction, maybe not as many novels, maybe as many, maybe more, where we'll see a defined section, though, that will go in and we'll just suddenly notice where we have seen booksellers also, not just marketing thrillers or crime, but of course, sort of bundling them according to geographical region as well. So do you think we will start to see a bit of a Frenchy corner?
It's an interesting point. I think less so with France, because actually the French writers are less easy to define geographically in that way. Because what you do have with the Scandinavian stuff is it's all cold, isn't it? And I remember and I actually worked at Hatchard's bookshop at the time, and we had a table and we called it Crime in a Cold Climate. And it has that very, you know, you can use the same images to link them. Whereas the French titles, I think, you know, some of them are in snowy landscapes in the Alps, but then obviously Paris, it's very urban. So there's not quite the same defining characteristics, I don't think.
One thing, certainly not all books that have come out of Scandinavia, but there has always been a little bit of the moral questioning that you get in these very particular social liberal democracies. And in many ways, there's many shared experiences, of course, with France as well. But that was also something that has really sort of, you know, bound, I think, much of the moral debate in those books. Do you think that is maybe something as well where there's a little bit more fluidity in France as well? That's not that common sort of shared value. If you're a Norwegian and if you're a Dane, there's much you sort of share when you think about social democracies.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I'm always really interested in crime fiction as a vehicle to explore social issues. And I think we see that that's always been the case. You know, when Emile Zola was writing novels, when he was writing about Thérèse Raquin, he was using effectively a thriller to look at how people in Paris lived. And that continues to be an issue. So I think it's always interesting to see how that works. That's interesting in Irish crime as well. So a lot of the, you know, the Irish Recession is being looked at through crime thrillers and being explored through the vehicle of crime by, say, for example, Tana French, who writes very well about it.
Now, is there a bigger business angle to it? Nothing new, of course, that, of course, you know, rights are bought and books are translated into all sorts of languages. But if I'm a major publisher right now, am I jumping on a bit of a bandwagon to say, look at, you know, without too much marketing, a lot of the hard work has been done, and certainly I don't have to, you know, go for maybe the same. Well, there are no advance rights. I'm just picking these things up. I might have to redesign the cover jacket. Maybe I don't have to, but I'm just going to pay for the translation. Is there a bit of an upside in this that they think that, okay, we can ride France, and then, you know, we might be off to Italy, or we might be off to somewhere else next?
I mean, I think certainly what definitely happens in publishing is once something is successful, publishers are then looking for something like the thing that's just been successful.
Yeah.
So, and there is a sort of a shorthand to it. I mean, I'm quite a Francophile, and I must say, for me, I like it. Really, it draws me to a book. If there's I like the way France is communicated on book covers. I like the titles. I like the names. I like the place names. It's reasonably familiar to an English audience, so I can see it working very well and continuing to.
Just before we went on air, I was trying to remember the name of give it a shorthand, probably sort of the Robert Ludlum of France, maybe a little bit of John le Carré, but maybe more racy. And the gentleman is Gerard de Villiers, who died last year. But I was just looking at this piece in the New York Times right now, and it said that he sold 100 million books in France. And yet I was trying to look for him in English on Amazon and elsewhere the other day, and didn't show up in English. And here I'm thinking, just when everyone is looking for, you know, who could be, you know, the next Jason Bourne.
I think that's a very good idea. I think you need to phone a publisher friend and ask for a cut.
Well, I was going to say, I think maybe sort of Monocle Editions could do it or something like that. But, you know, when you look at that, and I just want to go back to the sort of the state of publishers right now, and just maybe we can get a bit of a business update. Probably the numbers aren't all in for 2013, but I would imagine everyone knows how they did at Christmas, etc. Are you licking your wounds if it's mid-February and you're one of the major publishers right now, or you're thinking, oh, you know what, summer's upon us almost, and things are going to be good? What's the state of the industry right now?
I mean, obviously, the publishing industry is in flux. Everybody knows that. Everybody's coping with what, certainly in the UK, is an avalanche to e-reading and digital. Less so in France, actually, interestingly.
Germany, too.
Yeah, e-reading kind of hasn't taken off in the same way. And Certainly in France, more support for independent bookshops, governmental support for independent bookshops. So yes, there are issues, but actually I don't think it's as bleak as I think sometimes we're inclined in this country to talk ourselves into an early grave.
Indeed. For listeners around the world, people who might be shuffling off at the weekend, looking to maybe put something into their tote bag or hold all, anything stand out from two or three, at least, authors or indeed lovely French jackets to look for this weekend?
Well, I think if you wanted to just start with the French crime, Fred Vargas is a great writer and an archaeologist. And she's actually been around for a while. She's called Fred and she's a woman, which is one of those things that you can often go wrong on. Mm. But she's great. And I'm just about to start reading what could be the next big thing, which is called The Truth
About... Let's see the cover. Let me see.
Yeah. The Truth About the Harry Querbeer Affair.
Okay.
By Joel Dicker. This has been a massive bestseller in lots of parts of the world. And that's interesting because it's set in New England, written by... the author is Swiss, but he writes in French.
Right, so Swiss roman.
And now, obviously, I will read it in English.
And did quite serious numbers. So
absolutely.
The proof is in it. It already did well across... the French-speaking world.
And it hailed, it says, as a great American novel, despite its Swiss authorship, which is, I always love it when we get a bit cosmopolitan.
Absolutely. I was also going to say this. Also, just it's a slightly Hopper-esque cover as well. So you sort of look at it. And I do like the art direction. It's a rather sort of oddly kind of weird academic art direction, but not art directed.
Yes. And I've only read the first sort of four or five pages, but it's absolutely cracking so far.
Okay, excellent. You heard it here first. Kathy Rensenbrink, Associate Editor at The Bookseller. Thanks very much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Happy weekend. You're listening to Midori House, coming up to 10 to the hour. We're going away for a short break. Back after this.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
And you are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're fast approaching the end of this program. But before we go, time for our daily review segment, where we go through the best in books, theatre, art, music and cinema with our correspondents and contributors around the world. Today we talk cinema. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco discussed the ins and outs of the Berlin Film Festival with The Telegraph's movie critic, Tim Robey.
Let's talk about the main winner, Black Hole Thin Ice from China. First of all, were you surprised that he won, or was kind of expected?
I think people felt that maybe Boyhood, the Linklater film, was going to win, ended up winning Best Director instead. Having been in Sundance, you can kind of see the logic of that. It's not a film that needed that prize, really. So Black Hole Thin Ice was an interesting kind of choice to sort of highlight one of the lesser or smaller films from lower down the list, which I thought was a really, really good style exercise, this film. Actually, it's kind of fascinating on a stylistic level. It's a sort of murder mystery crime drama set in northern China, and it starts in 1999, where a human hand is found kind of going around the conveyor belt of this coal plant. And the immediate investigation is to who this belongs to and who is culpable. Then it jumps forward in time and does this very interesting time jump in the middle of one shot that the camera's travelling under a sort of snowy underpass, and we suddenly arrive in 2004, where the only surviving policeman from that investigation has become a security guard, and further murders keep occurring, and they're kind of like copycat crimes, so he has to kind of get back into the investigation and figure out what's going on. It's quite a confounding film. I think everyone emerges from it thinking, kind of slightly scratching their heads about exactly how it all knits together. The plotting is quite oblique, I suppose, and the thing that really knits it together is it's so beautiful and kind of full of this kind of gliding menace all the time. There are shots of characters on ice rinks and someone stalking them around an ice rink, and it's done in one unbroken take. It's kind of mesmerizing and quite hypnotic, and yeah.
I've seen only the trailer, and indeed it looks great. In the trailer they show the scene of when the hand appears suddenly in the... Well, let's talk about Boyhood then. I mean, the critics loved it. Actually, I was expecting this Boyhood to win, and you as well, I believe. So tell me more, what did you think about Boyhood?
Boyhood, obviously, the main thing about Boyhood is that it was made over 12 years. Richard Linklater started shooting it back in 2001, I believe, and he uses the same actors all the way through. In the case of the main character, L.R. Coltrane is the name of the actor, and he goes from being a kid of, I think, 8 or 9, all the way through into his late teens and college years. And he really kind of is the center of the story. But his parents in it are played by Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette. And they're a separated couple. And their various kind of tribulations are another kind of subplot in the story. We know that Linklater has done this kind of patterning of storytelling before, but just not within a single film. He did it in his trilogy Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and Before Midnight, in which 9 years elapsed between each film. But this time it's all within one feature, and he's cut it down to just under 3 hours. The whole saga, it's like a coming-of-age kind of Bildungsroman type of story. And I thought it was beautiful and quite sort of casual in a way. It doesn't feel as though it's kind of making big points. It's actually just about the kind of everyday transitions in life that you kind of go through. I love the performances, and I thought it was a really, really strong film.
And I have to ask before I go, a film that I'm very curious about, the co-production between Brazil and Germany, A Praia do Futuro, very divisive. Did you like it?
I actually did like it. It was one of the most divisive films there. I actually don't think I've seen a film which got every single possible mark on the grid of critics that Screen International polls every day. It got everything from an X rating for terrible to a 4 stars from the Brazilian critic for wonderful. I gave it 3.
Eu tenho dois tipos de medo e de coragem. O meu é de quem finge que nada é perigoso.
I like the director a great deal. He's called Karim Aynouz. He made a film called Madame Satar about 10 years ago about a drag queen in Rio. But this is a very fragmentary love story between Wagner Moura, who's an actor we may recognize from the Elite Squad movies, and this other guy who, Wagner Moura, is a lifeguard, and he's sort of on patrol on the beach in Rio and helps save this one guy, but his friend is washed away. He's a surfer. And the two of them kind of develop this romance, and then it kind of jumps when Wagner Moura takes the decision to move to Berlin with this guy. But it's also about what he's left behind in Brazil and the family he's left behind, and there are kind of very kind of abrupt time leaps forward, you know, as much as 10 years can elapse. It's a film that kind of builds to very, very high melodramatic peaks. And some people, I think, felt that it didn't really earn those. It kind of jumps at them. I kind of like that style. It reminds me of Almodovar in some ways. It's kind of very heightened. The music is gorgeous. And there are some absolutely beautiful sequences of them on motorbikes, cycling around on the coast. It overworks some of its metaphors, I think, which is why I didn't give it the kind of full 4 stars. But I actually thought it was really tremendous.
Tim Roby of The Telegraph, the film critic, talking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, as the weekend is kicking in here in Europe, a little word of caution. If you're standing near the border in Switzerland and see a threatening, unidentified flying object hurtling toward the Confederation's airspace, well, you'd be wise to ring the Defense Department. Then again, after the Swiss Air Force failed to provide an escort to that Ethiopian Airline 767 that was hijacked by its co-pilot earlier in the week, and of course landed in Switzerland, you might hear something like this if you dialed up.
Grüezi. Hier spricht automatische Telefonbeantworter der Schweizer Luftwaffe. Für Deutsch drückt die bitte die Taste 1. Pour le français, tapez la touche 2. For English, please press 3. You have reached the Swiss Air Force outside of our official office hours, which are 8 to 1700. If you would like to report an incursion in the Swiss airspace, please dial 1 to speak to the Italians, 2 to speak to the French, and 3 to speak to the German Air Force. They will be able to assist you.
Probably a few rather sort of red faces, I would say, in and around Bern this week. Not Switzerland at its best, indeed not. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today's show. Our program was produced by Daphne Denny and was looked after very ably on the audio front by our Alex Funnel. And of course, you probably know that you recognized the lovely tones, of course, of Jonathan Wheatley, who is reading the news. Jonathan, of course, is going to be here with all of our listeners throughout out right up until our last bulletin at midnight. I'm going to be here tomorrow morning, bright and early, with this week's edition of The Stack. That's tomorrow, 10 o'clock London time. And I'm also pairing up again with our editor, Andrew Tuck. We are going to be looking after the Monocle Weekly. Of course, that is at midday on Sunday, right here on Monocle 24. Till then, though, have a good weekend. Goodbye.
The Rolex Mentor and Protégé Arts Initiative sources young artists and brings them together with artistic masters for a year of mentoring. For mentors, it's a year to share their passion and expertise. For protégés, it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to observe and work alongside some of the world's greatest artists. 1 year can inspire a lifetime. Rolex.